I would like to acknowledge the Guringai people and pay my respects to the elders both past and present. The Guringai people are the traditional owners of this land where we meet today. Ben Thatcher embodies the qualities of resilience and hope in the face of adversity. Ben is an ARIA-nominated children's artist, and he is the driving force between Major Minor Music Australia. He champions music for families with unwavering passion. Navigating chronic illness with strength and determination, his journey is a testament to the human spirit's resilience.
Welcome to Sharing Stories, Changing Lives. The host, Karen Sander, has the privilege of interviewing individuals from all walks of life, each with their own powerful and inspiring stories. The guests share their life experiences, and in doing so, they celebrate the transformative magic of storytelling. To learn more, visit www.thestoryroom.au and explore the private membership area, the Backstage Pass.
Ben, you are a family man and you are a musician, and it would be fabulous to learn more about your life and your career.
Okay, I'll give you the reasonably watered down one, only because I have just turned 50 and I've never really had much of a plan, so that means you kind of meander around quite a lot. I grew up in Sydney, Australia, down in the Shire, pretty normal up. Bringing and stuff, nothing particularly exciting. It was all lovely and nice. Parents had separated, but in hindsight, it was really more or less the best thing for them both. So, you know, I can't look back on that with any regret. Quite early on when I left, I guess musically I fell in love with music about 12, I guess around the same time your hormones are trying to work out who you are and the things you want to say and, you know, and looking for ways to be able to express myself, I found a voice through music, I guess. I did that simultaneously while trying to get through school. They didn't really cross paths, those two elements. And then when I was about 18, 19, I left the Shire and moved into the sort of into central Sydney, which is kind of where I spent the majority of my life. I guess in regards to who I am here today, around that time I did have a job for an accounting firm, a really large accounting firm.
That doesn't sound like you.
Yeah, it's amazing. But I got this job because I was just looking, I just needed, you know, I had, let's just say I had bypassed all successful attempts to enter university. So I found myself looking for a job and I found this accounting firm, but it was one of the really big ones. For those of you that out there that remember, it was KPMG Pete Marwick. And then they offered me an internship and were going to put me through university and just sort of start working me up to be a manager, then eventually partner of this particular department, which to me was insane. I spent half my time with my shoes off, running around with my socks on and just generally running amok. So I found that a little bit strange and I couldn't help but notice that the department they were talking about was predominantly female except for me, and they seemed to have only offered me that kind of opportunity, and there was a lot of other people there that were taking it much more serious than me. Anyway, they said, go home and think about it and think about how you want to do it, and so I did, and I essentially went home and wrote my resignation letter because I guess in hindsight I was just like, this is just not me. This is ridiculous. I liked the dressing up part of it. I enjoy kind of feeling, I guess, businessy, even if it's just as a facade. But, yeah, no, not for me. So I went in the next day, chucked it in, much to their disappointment, and then a friend of mine who heard I was looking for a job rang and said, do you want to come and work at our childcare centre for a day? And that literally, as they say, is history, because that kind of sparked the next 25 years of my life. Now, within early childhood, I've done early childhood, long daycare, preschool, before and after school, kind of all the gamut. I taught in China for a while. I taught in London for a while. So it was the catalyst to kind of move me around wherever I wanted to go teaching was it. And particularly being a guy in early childhood, you're a bit of an anomaly. So I think the people that wanted you to work there really wanted you to work there because it was a good selling point for them. Running around with your shoes off in an accounting firm isn't an amazing trait, but it turns out to be perfect in an early childhood centre. So, you know, I don't know, maybe I was okay at it, maybe I was all right at teaching. To get to the I told you, I thought this was going to be a quick explanation, but then parallel to that, I always had music. So I did music, I did a lot of, I guess, co-op theatre and short films and things like this, and I always had my foot in that kind of artist. So it was like daytime, early childhood, nighttime, I would go and do these things. Sometimes with some success, but nothing huge. It was definitely where my heart was. It was where I felt most comfortable. And then about 15 years ago, my then partner, who's now my wife, Jo was working for a gentleman by the name of David Elphick. And David Elphick is a producer of Rabbit. Yes, he's produced Rabbit Proof Fence and all kinds of things. He's quite seminal. He's done some amazing stuff, started Tracks magazine. Really quite extraordinary guy, very wise and, yeah, really incredible. And Joe was a line producer on one of his films, and then he just said, "Hey, Benny's a musician and works for kids. We're doing a pilot. Can he just write some songs for this pilot?" And I went, "Sure, I can do that." And then I did, and I think there was just a moment where we all just kind of stood back and went, they're actually not too bad. They're actually pretty good. And I think we're all none of us were shocked, but I think we all kind of were a bit shocked. And then so subsequently I found myself in Singapore with this gentleman who wanted to film 10 episodes of this TV pilot David and I had come up with. It was just me with a group of children, and that's when I wrote more and more, and then I had my first album, and that's when I did that. And it's kind of – but I was still working in early childhood. That's kind of what it was. So that's sort of how those two worlds, is a very brief version, but that's how those two worlds kind of collided into each other. And from that point on, all my pursuits have been based around that children's entertainment kind of world. So I do a lot of clips for children's artists and things like that. And I would say nowadays early childhood entertainment is, or children's entertainment is really where a lot of my creative juices and experiences fly, really. Yeah.
It seems like it was quite serendipitous, you know, you sort of fell into it through Joe.
Yeah, I think that's kind of quite indicative of my life. I think looking back emotionally, I may have sort of found life a bit tricky, but then in some respects I think I've been incredibly fortunate that I've been able to do some really exciting things, I think. I've been able to do things that, and I've done them really on the whim and an empty bag. I've just got up and gone, "Oh, well, I'll throw a pair of shorts in and let's go." And it's put me in some really amazing places that I would, you know, obviously I've learned a lot from and have taught me a lot. And so I don't know. I often think about this. Like, I think it is quite serendipitous, and you know, with Joe and things like that. But then at the same time, I don't know. I guess that's what happens when you do just sort of hoist a sail, right, and let the wind kind of take you. I've been fortunate enough to be surrounded by people that have always helped. So, like, you know, my father in particular is always the first person to jump in and go, "All right, how much money do you need to bankroll that?" And he sort of usually helps me through that sort of portion of it. And
I'm putting my hand up, Dad.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's grown to understand that it's who I am, and he's a huge supporter of it now. But it's and my mum, like everyone, I've been quite lucky that way. I think there's and particularly with Joe, I think Joe's amazing. Of course, she's amazing. I mean, I married her. That's, you know, that's part of why I married her, because she's amazing. She kind of knows what I sort of need to do, and I think she's quite. Yeah, she's quite good at just kind of going, I get it. Yeah, I get it. You need to do that. You know, it doesn't mean I disappear for 6 months and go and roll around in the desert somewhere. It just means, can I just spend the whole day just making a clip for somebody? And she's like, go and do it. It's okay. You know, so it's my very minute versions of like middle age crisis and things like that. I think I've been around people like that that have probably seen stuff in me that I've never seen. And I guess from that perspective, I've always been subconsciously, without me knowing, have been uplifted by the people around me. So
you're a young man, and I say that because you are a young man. Not too long ago, discovered you had an illness called PBC. Can you say the long form for me so I get it right?
So there's a couple of versions of it, PBC and PSC, and PSC is the one that they've sort of given to me, but they're kind of more or less they're the same thing. So I've got PSC, which is primary sclerosing cholangitis. And essentially what that is my immune system, for whatever reason, has decided the biliary system within my liver is foreign and it's just doing its best to try to kill it off. And unfortunately, being in the liver, as it tries to destroy my biliary system, it's creating all kinds of havoc through the rest of my body, which is very great, you know, wonderful, wonderful thing for it to do.
Has this condition impacted your life?
It's for the first couple of years it didn't, because I was just blatantly refusing to let it. I was in a position when they first happened, it was after a couple of years of big analysis and looking through a lot of physical stuff that I had these things going on with me, and they were saying, oh, it's probably this, it's probably that, it's probably this. And then we spent a year. I eventually went to my GP and went, there's something else happening. Can you start with my toes and work to my head and let's check everything that's in me? And then through all of that, over about a year and a half, I then found myself in hospital with a blood clot in my liver. And in this portal vein, which is this enormous vein that runs through your stomach and everything. And that's when they went, we're upgrading you from what we thought you had. We're now giving you the PSC diagnosis. The only problem with PSC is it comes with a lifespan. It shortens your life. It can shorten it quite considerably, or it can shorten it just enough for it to be a pain in the ass. My version, they feel, is going to be a little bit more significant. And at the time when it happened, they said the way it's going to work, you have 50% chance of dying by the end of the year, after they told me. I've subsequently learned that 50% is kind of every year now. They're just like, well, when it hits you, it's going to hit you so quick, it'll just be done. Part of the treatment are things like transplant. That's the ultimate part of the treatment. You take an enormous amount of medication and all this kind of crap. But what it does do, I guess, for me, or what it did do for me, is you are faced with an enormous reality, an enormously stark reality very quickly that you've just never had to contemplate before, because I guess you think you're going to live forever, and even as a 50-year-old you still just think you're going to live forever. This kind of doesn't become relevant. And then all of a sudden to be told, you know, my daughter's just starting high school next year, and we still understand that there's an enormous risk I'm not going to see a finish. And that's 6 years away. Like, that's not long at all. Trying to come to terms with that has changed the way, I don't know if it's the way I've seen the world. I don't know if it's changed the way I see people. I think it's just the way I see my interaction with the world and people. I don't think it's changed my view of other things, but it's changed the view of what I need to be within all those situations, which I don't exactly know how to explain, but it just means.
How do you explain what you feel?
I guess I was talking to someone about this recently, and I guess you know, being a child of the 70s, and you sort of watch the 80s excess and all that kind of stuff, you kind of. We do fundamentally have a society where it's very much like, how do you ensure your own safety? How do you ensure your own, for the lack of a better word, legacy? How do you make sure you're okay? How do you protect yourself against other things that are around you? I guess, you know, a lot of that is kind of, it's a conflict. You're sort of always in this state of conflict where you're sort of always. There's a level of competition constantly. You're in this competition about how do you ensure that you're making sure you're doing okay, and And I think for me, and I think also a lot of mental health issues growing up, well into my 40s for, you know, various reasons. But I think I lived a life really, really in a lot of conflict, very angry, looking for the conflict in everything. And I guess what has changed is I don't look, the conflict element has left me. This is a combination of the illness and a lot, 20 odd years of therapy. But I think it's that switch between what's more important to you, engaging in the conflict of the situation or just engaging in the collaboration of the situation. And it doesn't mean conflict, you're always looking for a fight, but you're always, there's an element that you're always sort of protecting your own interests in everything. And I think for me, I maybe start to understand now that I can protect my interests while very well and truly protecting the interests of the other person in the situation. No one needs to win. It's not important that one person wins over another. And I think that's, yeah, I guess that's what I mean by the world didn't change. I think I just, my place within the world, I think, just shifted a little bit.
Was there a time that you, when you were diagnosed, that you just wanted to sit on the couch and feel sorry for yourself?
Yeah, still do constantly. When it first happened, Joe and I went through this thing which I'd never really heard of before, that a few people have brought up since, kind of loosely referred to as pre-grieving, where you grieve something that's about to happen. And I think I've used it before. The best example I can think of is being a parent sending a child off to something like World War One or Two or Vietnam, probably more prevalent in those wars, knowing full well you're probably never going to see your son again, and it's a miracle if you do. And that's an awful situation to know something terrible is coming. And so we went through this big period of pre-grieving where we had to really confront the idea that what we had and what we created, and it is really beautiful. I mean, I a lot of people say it, but I'm really fortunate. My children love each other. It's quite obscene. My wife and I are really close. Like we have a really nice, you know, it's a very
sounds dysfunctional. I don't know many families like that.
Well, it's a bit weird. It's a little bit one of those picture postcard families that in reality there is no picture of a family like that. So we're quite fortunate, and just to have to really confront that that's going to fall apart. And that was really hard. And Joe and I had to sort of really, really just take turns working out who was, like, we'd take turns. One night someone would have to be there for the children to be strong and the other person would break down. I saw a lot of uselessness in the things around me for a great period. There's one great story where I went to, every year I'd buy this one particular jumper. It's this nice black jumper that I like. I wear it all the time. I wear it to death every winter, and I get a new one the following winter. And I remember walking into the shop and needing a new one and just went, it just doesn't matter. What's the point? I'll just wear the one with holes. It doesn't matter. I don't, there's no reason to try to look good or look comfortable. And I still have those days. It's not like they've disappeared. I guess it's like anything, right? You just got to go through that process, and because it's a big process. So I don't know. I think everyone just does it their own way, really.
If you're interested in getting more involved in our community, connecting with people who share your interests, you can do this by visiting our website at www.thestoryroom.au.
How do you go about family relationships and social activities? You know, how do you manage these aspects of your life? Are there things you do with your family? Are there things you can't do socially?
There's two ideas to that. There's the physical. My health in the last 3 or 4 months has had quite a marked decrease, and they're still trying to figure out what's going on. But it physically has made things very difficult, and that weirdly just brings, again, a whole level of emotional, it's a whole other layer of baggage to unpack, to know that your body's just physically not letting you do things. It's like today, obviously I'm at home with the children and at school holidays, but Joe has taken them in to work with her today because yesterday my brain kind of went and I was starting to lose my balance and I couldn't think properly and I was staring at the cupboard for about half an hour trying to work out what was for dinner but didn't understand what I was looking at and I had to send her a message and go, are you on your way home? You might need to run some red lights, please. So she just, while I passed out in bed, she organised to take the children in so today I could really just sit around and do nothing. And that's a really difficult thing to come to terms with. That's really hard. I think it's hard for me because I kind of am quite busy as well. I take on way too many projects. So there's the emotional side of it I think is really hard. But that's the physical side of it. The emotional side, emotions are kind of strange. You just sort of have to pull the brake on when you have to pull the brake on. And I'm just getting better at going, I'm not coming. I'm not doing that. I had a really good friend down from Queensland recently and he was here for 4 days and every day we tried to meet up and every day I just went, it's not happening, I can't do it, I can't do it. And eventually I said, look, if you want to see me, you're going to have to come here to my house and sit at the foot of the bed and we'll have a coffee, and which he did, which was amazing. The emotional struggle is with my own sense of not being able to do the things that I know I should be able to do. And that's the hardest thing. I think the physical side of it, it's hard living with a chronic illness. People just always talk about how good you look and you're just like, okay, that's great. Can I go over there and throw up and lie down? But the physical, it's until you meet someone who shares a chronic illness, honestly, you really are just talking to people that just truly don't understand. And then when you meet someone who does, it's like, oh, my God, and you hug and you cry and go, I know, right, how about this? And then you talk about things that you never knew bothered you. But, yeah, the emotional bit's the toughest.
Is it like a balancing act all the time?
Yeah, constantly. It's the physical and the emotional, and I guess emotional, it's the next wave, right? You deal with it, you've got to deal with it the way you can deal with it, and then you come out of it and you're fine and wait for the next one to take over. So
in a way, you have to honour yourself by being a bit selfish. What feels selfish, but it's what you need.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. Like we get fed a lot of stuff about, you know, you got to take care of yourself and you got to, but we have none of us do. We all still feel sick in the stomach when we tell people, no, I don't want to come to dinner with you. There is a point, which is actually kind of nice in a way. There's a point where I just have to do it. And it's kind of, there's some nice lessons in that to be able to go, oh, that's actually not that hard. And I'm also getting better that if I feel the other person might be offended, I'm kind of a bit like, well, that's, you know, whatever. I can't do anything about that. And, yeah, it's a tough way to learn all these things that you're supposed to know from birth and that you're supposed to learn through Facebook memes. But it's still some lessons that are nice to learn, I guess.
You better just write to Zuckerberg and say, look, how am I supposed to learn this, Mr. Zucker?
Yeah, that crap on your stuff really has not helped. Here's what I've found helped. Yeah, I've learned so much so quickly in the last 4 or 5 years about myself, really about myself.
What insights and lessons have you learned about yourself and how do you maintain a sense of hope and a sense of positivity in your life? Because a lot of people walk around and their life, you know, seems all rosy, but they're always, you know, unhappy or, you know, nothing's quite right.
I must say, I was talking to someone the other day and I said, I feel like a lot of people my age, there's a lot of people slowly caving into just being really angry. And I've spent so long angry that I'm sort of drifting the other way. And it's become really noticeable to me, the amount of people I see around and go, man, you're really angry about that. And I just don't think it matters. I think for me, one of the biggest things that happened, and this kind of happened in a combination of therapy and then getting ill, is I don't toot my own horn often. I'm not comfortable with it. And even doing something like this, I still just think, who cares what I think? But one thing that I am really proud of that I've learned in the last 4 years, and I learned it was a combination of therapy and then getting ill, was just how unbelievably important it was to just let whatever emotion's going through your body, just to let it out, just to let it just do its thing. That doesn't mean if you're angry, go pick a fight. But if I'm angry about something, I will really quite openly go to Joe and say, hey, super frustrated. I don't know what's going on. I'm pretty shitty. I'm just going to go see a film. I'll pick a comedy and whatever I'm shit, or I'll go see something that's going to make me angrier and just let it, just let it get out. Just let it out. Just let it have its way. You know, don't, you know, we're so afraid of being angry and being sad and being negative and being all those things. And I think that's a shame, because all of those emotions, they're not only what defines us, I think they're the things that make the remainder emotions so much more powerful. You know, like joy is so much stronger if you really understand and are happy to sit in sadness. You know, strength is so much more compelling and rewarding if you understand what it's like to feel weak. And I think for me, one of the biggest things is, and again, it's different physically. I'm starting to understand the idea of having to cave into the physical and go, I cannot do this and I just need to lie down. But the emotional things, I really allow whatever emotion is happening, I just let it out. And I keep the people around me well aware of how I'm feeling. And I do it with my children as well. They're 12 and 8, but there's times when we'll be driving and I'll just say to the kids, hey, listen, Dad's feeling he's going to get really frustrated soon, not at you, but I'm just feeling it grow. Do you mind if we just have a bit of quiet time? Let's just chill out a bit in the car and not scream and laugh so much. And they're great. They go, yeah, sure. And I think I'm quite good at allowing myself to engage in those perceived negative emotions. And I think in doing it, you just naturally rise yourself up even higher on the ones that are positive.
So ultimately, what are your options in terms of medical assistance, medical health, medication? Where do you go from Ben today with PSC?
Do you just mean the physically what progresses from here? How do we look?
What sort of treatments, you know, they say you've got 50% chance every year of living. What do they do for you?
So what they do is, what their main concern is what happens is these things called, in my biliary system, create these things called beading. And I've used this example in the past. If you imagine a snake that's eating an apple whole, and then it just keeps eating apples whole. You have skinny snake, then big apple lump, skinny snake, big apple lump, skinny snake. And that's what my biliary system looks like. And the fear is, well, not the fear, what traditionally happens is those inflamed bits, the apple bits, they do two things. That flesh will either turn into cancerous things, or they'll turn into, or they'll get so big they'll block the whole system. While it's doing that, because of that damage, it creates cirrhosis of the liver, which then starts blocking off some of the bigger veins that run through the liver, and then it starts blocking off passages to the spleen and the gallbladder, so they all start. So it's all a bit of a mess. What happens is two things. They're either going to become cancerous, and if it's early enough, they might be able to treat it. Once they treat you for cancer, they can't do a transplant. Or the other side of it is you get a transplant. Until that happens, you take about 8 tablets in the morning and about 5 at night. You obviously have to be careful with what you eat. I'm not amazing at that portion of it, but I can tell your body doesn't necessarily get any worse. It just feels awful. So you kind of tend to not eat terrible stuff. But a transplant's the end game. The only problem is once you get the transplant is PSC quite regularly can just come back and get the new liver. So you're only giving it a fresh basket of fruit, really.
So it's not a be all and end all having a transplant, but it does.
No. It's always been sold to me as a transplant is part of the treatment, it's not the cure. Otherwise, they would probably do the transplant quite early on. But of course, with transplants, which I claim to have known nothing about this 4 years ago, but with transplants, because Because obviously the thing people say to me, well, why don't you get, if they know you're going to have to get one, why don't you get one now and avoid all the pain and the discomfort? But the problem is there's a 10% unsuccessful rate with transplant recipients in the first year. So until your illness is strong, is bad enough that you have less than 10% chance of living through the next year, that's when you get the transplant. Now, the problem with me is when mine kicks in, it'll be really quick and you just, fingers crossed, hope it all rolls out quick enough before the disease kind of gets too full on and makes a transplant too difficult. It all sounds doom and gloom, but if you spoke to a transplant doctor, I'm sure they'd be like, nah, just stop it. It's easy. We'll blah, 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 blah.
It's okay. We'll just fix that up, you know. We'll just whip one in here, you know,
yeah,
and have it waiting for you.
But that's always my biggest thing. I've been really unwell for the last 4 months and I went and had an appointment last week and they just said, look, your liver's tracking well. We think there might be some internal bleeding, so we're going to go do a few extra tests. But you're just kind of going, how, that's for me the hardest thing to go to sleep with every night is just how sick, if I feel this bad now, how sick do I have to get? How sick do I eventually have to be before you get the transplant? And that's terrifying because I can't picture that kind of illness. I don't know what that looks like.
I guess it's maybe something that you don't try to picture too often, but I know having an amazing family, you have Joe and you have two children, and obviously your own parents, your mum and dad. How has music helped you while you've been so ill?
I think the big thing that music did, it wasn't so much what music did for me, it's what the illness did for my music. I think what it did was it made me much more braver. Like the album in particular that got nominated for the ARIA, which was the last album, it was a huge album. It's got people performing on it from New Zealand, New York. It's got a couple of guests on every track. It was a huge undertaking, took a good 2 years to complete. The difference was with this particular album is I didn't want to compromise on any of my art anymore. I mean, on what I was doing, I didn't want to compromise on my music, and being sick and having an understanding of that time frame made me go, all those things that probably in the past would have gone a bit hard, I don't do now. I go, no, that's how I want it and I want it to sound like that. I never want to look at anything and regret not having done something. And I think that's what's changed a lot, because musically you're writing music for kids. I have one album, this was before I got unwell, and it's stories and poems, and it talks about death, and there's stories about identity, and there's stories about social anxiety and things like that. But this album, once being ill, it's been strange. I haven't really wanted to bring that into music for children just because I didn't know how to say it without it being too personal. But being unwell, what it has made me realise is there's just things I really want to do, and I've wanted to do them for years, and it's time to just do them and stop finding reasons not to. And I think that's been the biggest blessing of all of it, is to go through that projects folder, open them all up, start at the top, how can I make this one the best thing it possibly can, and taking the pressure off everything needing to be successful and huge, which I think stops so many people doing everything. Like, it's okay just to kind of keep doing it and you get better every time, and it doesn't, you know. Music is a bit different because I'm very content and stable in my music, so the illness didn't necessarily have too much of an impact on that, but it had impact on, you know, film clips. All of a sudden I needed to up my skill set on film clips. How do I now approach bigger artists? How can I do bigger things that more people will see, and major minor music and things like that? I think it just made me realise that there's no point not doing stuff anymore, really, I think, is all it came down to.
Ben, what is the name of this album? Because people might want to know about it.
So I'm a children's artist by the name of Benny Time, and the album is called Benny and Friends. It was released in 2021. The new one's coming out in about 3 months, and that's called Benny's Garden. But if you go to Benny Time on Spotify or bennytime.com, it's Benny and Friends, and, it's just fun and big and huge and You know, it's got some. It has got this one really beautiful song on it. Now think about it. There's one of the most successful songs on it is with this gospel choir from Harlem singing with myself and a friend of mine, Claudia Robin Gunn, who's a children's artist in New Zealand, and it's about this little cloud who's really heavy and grey, and all the big clouds come and tell it's okay to cry. All the clouds have to cry someday, and then it cries and it rains, and when it rains it waters all the fields, and then it feels really great and looks around and sees all the big clouds are crying. And I think that's a direct reference to the health thing of just like you just got to – and about the emotion thing that I was talking about earlier, that you have to engage in emotions, otherwise you're screwed, really. You have to acknowledge them and give them space.
Well, Ben, you are an amazing man. I only recently met you and I loved meeting you. It was wonderful. And you agreed to give me this time, which is even better. I love you more for the time. Thanks, Ben.
All right. See, well, thank you very much for having me. And do we just – it's just back this way, is it, through behind this curtain?
Yeah,
is this how we get backstage?
Door. We're going backstage. Yep. And we're going to have a backstage chat. How's that sound?
Yep, beautiful. Done. All right, thank you so much for having me on the front end of the stage. I appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to Sharing Stories, Changing Lives. We'd like to invite you to support us by purchasing a backstage pass, costing about the same as 2 cups of coffee each month. With the Backstage Pass, you'll gain access to workshops and exclusive content, including videos from our live events. You can do this by visiting our website at www.thestoryroom.au. We can continue to show that sharing stories changes lives.